this evening. I want to kind of do something of a wrap-up, but talking about parenting and parenting virtues, although I guess most of the folks, if not all of us in here, we have raised children and then some, maybe are in the process of raising grandchildren as well. But want to kind of take a look at virtues for parenting and virtues of parenting. And maybe, I heard that groan. Oh, I know, I'm just picking. When I started going like this and reaching for more. The doldrums. I've been there a few times myself, but not today. So. David L. Johns writes, "Parenting can be an unnerving prospect." Duh. "For it opens us to vulnerability, change, and being permanently shaped by the habits we practice. Yet as we parent with Christian intentionality, how may we be advanced in holiness by our children and shaped into new creations embodying hope, humility, and hospitality?" Robert B. Sloan, Jr., who happens to be president of Baylor University, writes, "What parents do may very well be the best teaching tool of the gospel. If we want our children to possess virtue, then we must be serious students of our own souls. If we pray that our children mature to dream dreams worthy of the kingdom, then we must allow a kingdom vision to guide our lives." In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 5 to 12, we read, "As you know, and as God is our witness, we never came with words of flattery, or with a pretext for greed, nor did we seek praise from mortals, whether from you or from others, though we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. But we were gentle among you, like a nurse tenderly caring for her own children. So deeply do we care for you that we are determined to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you have become very dear to us. You remember our labor and toil, brothers and sisters. We work night and day, so that we might not burden any of you while we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and God also, how pure, upright, and blameless our conduct was toward you believers. As you know, we dealt with each of you like a father with his children, urging and encouraging you and pleading that you lead a life worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory." And then we've read before from Deuteronomy, but Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7. "Keep these words that I am commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children and talk about them when you are at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand. Fix them as an emblem on your forehead." Virtue is defined as habits or dispositions to think, feel, and respond in appropriate ways. And they are developed over time by practice. In fact, many would contend that virtues should become practiced so much that they're second nature and become so ingrained that we don't need to be conscious of them anymore because they're part and parcel of who we are and how we face life. But you know, we're not born with virtue. We're not born with virtue. We have to develop them as we make good choices, as we learn about them. Aristotle said, "We learn a craft by practicing it, therefore we learn virtue by practicing virtue." What to you are the virtues and admirable character traits of a good parent?
Will that be patience? Exhibit that.
Yeah, patience.
I don't seem to have that down, so I'm waiting to give
one. That's God. That's right. What else? Any other? You know, we hear patience is a virtue, but what about other virtues? Okay. Proper love. Okay. Yeah, persistence. Nobody picked him up. Okay, patience, patience, proper love, persistence, wisdom. Discipline. Well, but we're talking about also a virtue of being a parent, to be disciplined. To be disciplined, not necessarily disciplining the child, but you also have to be patient and disciplined in how you discipline. David John suggests in an article that he wrote, the three primary virtues essential to Christian parenting in our culture are hope, humility, and hospitality. Hope, humility, and hospitality. That they are virtues essential to Christian parenting, especially in our day and time. In hope, and by the way, the passage while ago in 1 Thessalonians 2, you note that Paul talks to these people. Evidently, somebody has accused him of impure motives, and he says, we've come to you not demanding things that we could as apostles, but we've come to you to treat you like a mother treats her children, like a father treats his children. Bringing the gospel to the people out of a motive of love and care as a parent for the child. Hope. Who do we hope in? We hope in Christ, and the Old Testament says, our hope is in God. My hope is in God, the psalmist says, for I will hope in God, in Psalm 39. I hope in the Lord, also in Psalm 65. Our perspective, if we hope in the Lord, our perspective of Christ and our perspective of life and that of our children elongate. They lengthen. We don't take a short-term look. Here, John states, this hope needs to be grounded in God's grace and love rather than in us or our own children. You know, we hope in a lot of things, but essentially, if we are Christian, our hope should be grounded in God, not in our children. And even not in ourselves, because how can we put forth these virtues in and of ourselves? We really can't. He writes, this present moment, right now, and any present moment, anytime you're with your children, but this present moment does not contain all meaning. And we need to realize it is premature to give up on any child because their final chapter has not yet been written by God, and God continues to build a way in the wilderness. Hope in God, which goes along with patience when we're about to give up on the child, right? That goes with that patience, to hope in God, to build a way. It opens new possibilities for love, salvation, and enduring life because of God's Spirit within us. We also need to remember, in our hope, we hope that when we get to the point further along in our children's lives, that we will find, or we will realize, that great moral significance in what happens in families, intense involvement, the forming of character, the receiving of life, but also the releasing of life to an unknown future. First time that child goes wandering off to school. Sydney will start kindergarten this fall. Talk about time flies. the first time, I still remember the first time ever that either of our sons, that I allowed them out of the driveway by themselves in the car. And the hope and the prayers and standing there looking out every so often to make sure that, okay, when they were supposed to come home, that they were coming home. And if the telephone rang, your heart jumps up all the way in your throat. That's right. William?
That's got to fit in there somewhere, too. That's the same thing I think about. Something in the order of trust.
That trust.
Being able and willing and knowing when to let go.
Yeah. A lot of times that's tough to do. You know, especially if we're short-sighted, we need to realize that, you know, in all of this, if God is present, then as the life of our child unfolds, it's unfolding into a future where God is and where God shapes not only today, but the future. I was... Mary had a meeting yesterday and... over at Furman, a wedding meeting, but before she had that, there was a conference going on, and we got there, and I know you're never going to believe that the three women who were leading the conference ran overtime. You'd almost thought they were preachers. But as we got there, and toward the end, one of the women, African-American lady, said, was talking about her 36-year-old daughter, and she said, a couple of years ago, her 36-year-old daughter and she were talking about different things they had faced in life and how she brought her up. And she brought her up as a single mother. Well, she didn't bring the daughter up as a single mother, but the single mother brought up the daughter. And she said, we were talking, and she said, my daughter, I asked her, how come she's so angry all the time? And she flies off the handle so fast. And she said, well, Mom, while I was growing up, you showed me love, but you were always so angry so much of the time. You had reasons back then for your anger, but now I often find myself getting angry, but I don't have a clue as to why. And the woman said, it suddenly dawned on me. I realized my daughter had learned an attitude of anger first. So the question is, how do we keep from doing that and passing those kinds of attitudes on to our children or other kinds of attitudes? And we can't do it in a vacuum. Christopher Morse writes, who we are is only revealed in our relationship with others. As long as we're by ourselves, people don't really know who we are. But who we are is only revealed in our relationship with other people. Starting with parents. So as parents, we need to love God and teach and practice that love daily before our children so they'll learn that kind of love. Now, that doesn't mean we can't ever get angry. Sometimes there are very good reasons to, but we also need to be careful about how we do that and what our children pick up from that. Thomas Aquinas wrote about virtue, and he said there are natural virtues, which later were called the cardinal virtues. But he said there are natural virtues, habits that we can develop over time by exercising natural inborn capacities. These include practical wisdom, courage, justice, and thoughtful moderation of pleasure. And they're often called the cardinal virtues. But he said we also have infused virtues, dispositions given to us as gifts from God. God gives extra portions of courage and moderation to resist the effects of sin, and extra wisdom to hear and pursue God's calling. He said, in other words, the chief infused virtues are faith, hope, and love. They're sometimes called the theological virtues because they direct us toward God, and because we are to direct them toward God as well. So, faith, hope, love among the theological virtues. This sense of wisdom, courage, moderation, justice, cardinal virtues, which touch several of the ones that we've already mentioned here. But all of those, if they're not grounded in hope in God, then they're absolutely worthless. They have no foundation. A second virtue for parents, he says, is humility. humility. A challenge, which is a challenge to the temptation. Oh, wait a minute, excuse me, I got one more note down here that I didn't see. In classical Greek thought, though, hope is not a virtue. Christian thought with hope as a virtue is even beyond. It's a higher understanding. Classical Greek thought hope is not a virtue. Hope was released or unleashed upon human beings as an evil when Pandora's box was opened. If you go back and read about Pandora's box, one of the evils released was hope. In part because hopes are dashed so easily. But in Christian thought, hope is raised to a virtue because the hope is in God. So back to humility. A challenge to the temptation within our culture of materialism and consumerism is to see our children, which sees our children as consumer items to acquire in order to show our success, provide meaning to our lives, or, and I have seen this happen, to reunite a married couple drifting apart. I've seen that happen. There's not a child, they're drifting apart. They have a child to try and hold them together. Not because of a great deal of love, but as a commodity. And humility in parents should keep us from going along those lines, to go against the consumer materialistic mentality. Humility does not mean denigration, though. Humility means value and self-respect, a proper sense of value and self-respect for ourselves, but also for our children. If you read Colossians 3:12 and 1 Peter 5:5, says we should be clothed in humility. And to be clothed in humility is to understand that meaning, significance, and worth are not the attainments awarded to the most industrious, but that these, like children themselves, are gifts to us from God. One advantage of being clothed in humility is that by so doing, we no longer require the acceptance of the materialistic crowd. We don't have to have the materialistic crowd. Even though some see humility as a weakness, humility is really a strength. If you see it in the context of a gift from God and something that helps us to have a proper sense of value and self-respect. And if we have that proper sense of value and self-respect for ourselves, that's not narcissism, but an understanding of value, true value and worth, a sense of self-respect, then that is going to go toward helping our children develop a proper sense of values and self-respect. Unfortunately, in recent decades, I don't say years because it's been decades of it, and I know that there are a few people in this room that would absolutely attest to it because of their profession. We have unfortunately pushed off on the teachers in the public school system to teach values and self-respect. I don't have to tell some of you that on Wednesday nights, a lot of the children that come to us, this is the only place they may find some sense of value and self-respect. And not at home. But if we, who are parents or grandparents or serve as surrogate parents, even for an hour a week, don't have a proper understanding of value and self-respect for ourselves, we cannot see that value and treat those children with self-respect and build it within them. And then we may end up like this woman with the 36-year-old daughter who said, you know, I'm angry so much of the time I don't understand why I'm angry. I'm just angry. That's because of what she learned growing up. I keep reminding my children that it's those first 3 to 7 years, and once you get there, you know, that's the most important time, a formative time, to treat them with self-respect. I read an article, Raising Abel, that was written by Robert Sloan. And I sat back and said, you know, I did okay on some things, but some of this stuff I didn't do so good on. The third is hospitality. And you think, you know, parents, okay, hope, humility, hospitality. You know, I'm the mommy, that's why. That's on the humility thing. Mary used to have a sweatshirt that said that. Because I'm the mommy, that's why. Because I said so? Yeah. No, sometimes it's not a bad answer. But sometimes it can backfire. Yeah, right. The third, he says, is hospitality. A willingness to welcome the stranger. We're instructed in Romans 12:13 and Hebrews 13:2 to do that. A willingness to welcome a stranger. You say, wait a minute. Welcome a stranger? These are our children. They're an other. They're something other than we are. Whether they're biological or adopted or they come here on Wednesday nights, they're an other invading our lives, invading our space. They're a stranger. And really, when they first start out, they are a stranger. And when they get to, and when they hit teenage years, they're even stranger. Even more of a stranger. And sometimes when they get to 21 or 25, they take an exponential leap into strangeness. But and by the way, you know, you hear the thing, train up a child. People go that, train up a child the way he'll go when he is old, he will not depart from it. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we, if we train them and train them and train them up in the proper way and they move away, that we're a failure. We had to make our own decisions when we reached a point. So they too do so. But there's a greater chance if we have the proper sense of hope and humility and hospitality and a proper sense of value and self-respect and teach that to them and model it ourselves, that when they get to that point, while they'll make some mistakes, they'll be less likely to make the bigger ones and wallow in them for long periods of time. Doesn't mean they won't. We do. Robert, we do. We do. We need to remember that family is more, though, than merely blood kin. And children are more than what we can create or fully understand. And they're more than what we want them to be. The potential is greater than what we can imagine. So we need to, with a sense of humility and hospitality, see them as gifts rather than things that we created. But we need to remember, too, that family is more than merely blood kin, and showing hospitality is more than simply showing it to blood kin. We as Christians especially, when we pray, "Our Father, who art in heaven," that's a reminder that we're part of a worship, as part of a worshiping community, we are adopted sons and daughters. We're not blood kin. We're adopted sons and daughters, adopted into the family, and made sons and daughters because of the love and the care and the respect that God has for us. If God didn't have respect for us, we wouldn't have the ability to choose. And God wouldn't continue to care, even when we fail. If we don't have a proper sense of respect for our children, it questions a little bit of how much we care. We may want them to do certain things, but it all comes from that hope and sense of respect. In continuing, Robert Sloan suggests five items for reflection on parenting. First of all, we should not be afraid to talk with our children about God, the Bible, what we believe, and how this impacts our choices and the living of life. Some parents are afraid, well, what if I give the wrong answer? What if they ask a question I can't answer? What if they say, well, my friends say, and I don't have an answer for it? And that will happen whether we start out with them this big and reading to them and telling them stories, or whether we wait till they're this big. At some point, they're going to have their questions. They're going to have their friends that are going to ask the questions. But we shouldn't be afraid to talk with them about these things. And we shouldn't dodge the questions if we don't. I know children, especially younger children, think that parents and grandparents have all the answers. Well, most of the time. Then they get to an age when they realize we don't. And then don't think we have any answers, right? But, yeah, that's because they have them all. It's about the time they get to be 13. I knew that that number was 13 for a reason. But we should never be afraid to talk with them, even at a young age, about God, about the Bible. We mentioned the other week, read from, you might, when they're really young, start with one of those little children's Bibles that have the stories, little short stories about it. But as we go along, start moving along to a translation that they can understand. And when they get to reading, where they can read as well. Or what we believe. Well, why do you do this? Why do you believe this? Why do you believe that? What do you believe? And how it makes a difference in the choices we make. We should not only teach and practice, but we should live that teaching and practice before our children, before our grandchildren. We are to model and teach faithfulness to God, not just as creasters or baptisms or homecoming gatherings, but in everyday life. In everyday life. A lot of children who have some connection with church think that the only time that God's around is when you go to church. We need to practice it in everyday, ordinary, mundane life. That old story that I've told multiple times over the years about the but a true story about the little girl and her family leaving church one day, and they went out to the cafeteria to eat, someplace like K&W or something, went out to eat, and they went to sit down and they started eating, and the little girl said, sat there, and Daddy said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Well, aren't we going to say the blessing?" He said, "No, honey, we don't say the blessing in restaurants like this." And she said, "You mean God doesn't come out to restaurants?" Secondly, as parents, we should demonstrate consistency in our lives. In other words, linking what we say, what we teach, with what we do. I don't know if I say it down here anywhere else or not, but don't make promises that we have no intention to keep or we can't keep. Don't make promises that we can't keep or don't intend to keep. But link our words, what we say, what we teach, and our deeds. Yeah. That's extremely powerful. Generally where we see it in commercials is on the negative side, right? Or we used to anyway. Little boy sitting down next to his daddy beside a tree trunk. And daddy picks up, takes out a cigarette, lays a pack down, lights a cigarette, and the little boy picks it up, starts thumbing through and starts pulling out a cigarette. Or they're riding down the road and the dad finishes his burger and he just throws the wrapper out the window, and the little boy has finished with his, and so he looks at dad and rolls down the window and tosses it out, you know, anti-litter. What's the one that was around last fall that was much more deadly? Y'all don't ever watch those South Carolina highways or dieways where they're in the car and the man, you know, the seatbelt. "No, I'm not going to." And then you get down in this one scene and it's the child. The man survives, but the child didn't because he wouldn't buckle up either. Yeah. Children watch what we do more than they listen to our words. And that's very powerful. And I put the "or worst" in here, but as Sloan says, what parents do may be the best or worst teaching tool we have for our children in the sake of the gospel. And we can talk about it all day long. We should demonstrate it with our lives. The number of people growing up, you know, and maybe some of y'all are there. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. My parents went, they didn't just take us to church, they went with us. Even though my daddy was among those, he was the smoking crowd, had to get that one cigarette in between Sunday school and preaching. So they'd all rush out and stand out near the front and then go in. But they went with us. But how many children these days do we know of whose parents were lucky if they let them go or let somebody else take them? But they don't come with them. They don't go with them. And what does that say about church? What does that say about religion? It's not important. That's right. It's not important. Also, parents should exhibit accountability to each other and to their children. What? Accountable to my child? They're accountable to me. What I mean here is accountability as in we're going to live our lives the best that we can in front of our children, so they're not going to be asking those questions. Well, why did you say this but then you did that? Or why do I have to do this but you don't? You ever get that one? I did. Genuinely expressing devotion, faithfulness to each other also gives strength to us to parent our children. I've actually counseled with about three different couples in the last couple of weeks about weddings, two of which are going to be here in the last few weeks. And we talk about this. I ask, okay, what are the top stressors? Number one, sometimes they get it, and interestingly enough, all three of them got number one and number two, and I was impressed. Number one is money. Number two is kids. Three are the laws, in-laws, outlaws, sometimes laws, those kinds of things. But on number two, in talking about children, I said, how are you going to raise them? Are we going to have any? How many we want to have, and how are we going to raise them? How are we going to discipline them? What things are we going to teach them? Are we going to take them to church and be there with them or not? Who's going to be the tough one? Who's going to be the softy? All of those stresses. Well, if we genuinely express devotion and faithfulness to each other and discuss those things on a regular basis, then it not only provides us strength to parent our children, but when the children see that, children feel safe, do they not? They feel safe. They feel that they can count on that relationship and they can count on that love, and it also provides a good example for their future lives as adults. I really wonder sometimes, quite frankly, some of the children that we see on Wednesday nights, just how safe they feel at home and in their families. I know some of you know more about it than I do. You know, I've talked with a few of them on occasion over the years, and I've ridden the bus a few times and seen some of where they're coming from. But I often wonder how safe they feel at home. Here it is. Do not provoke children unnecessarily and discourage them. We're not, Colossians and Ephesians both say, do not provoke your children to anger, right? But it's also about discouraging them. That's where sometimes I used to pick on the boys, and I think sometimes I picked on them too much. But not to be mean, just. And then when they got to be in high school, they picked back. And do not make promises we cannot or do not intend to keep. If you make a promise and you don't keep it, what happens in the mind of that child? What do they think? Yeah. Sometimes they think it's their fault that you didn't, but they're not going to trust you the next time. And how can I trust you? You're supposed to be my mommy, you're supposed to be my daddy, you're supposed to be my grandparent, you're supposed to be this person caring for me and taking care of me, and then you made me a promise, but you didn't keep it. How can I trust you? Then how can I trust anybody else? And then what happens if they get to where they can't trust the parent? Somebody else promises them something, and then we see them on the news. These days especially. But part of that is to exhibit accountability to each other as parents, but accountability to the children. And by that, once again, I mean accountable from the standpoint of, you can trust me, I'm going to do what's best for you, I love you, I care for you, and I'm going to take care of you. And we must work hard at parenting. I like what Sloan says here. I tell folks this all the time. but we must work. I refer to this as the lunch pail principle. If you plan to be a good parent, bring your lunch pail, for it's an all-day affair. Children need time, not only quality time, but a quantity of quality time from their parents. Enough said? I kind of felt that way. And then we should cultivate the habit of blessing our children. Cultivate the habit of blessing our children. We need to realize and remember we have the power to bless and the power to curse, to help children grow or to crush them. Story I've told you before of the man whose son was very harsh and never darkened the doors of the church in that little first church I was in there, who got mad at his son and said, "Son, here's a shovel. He's 9 years old. Son, here's a shovel. I'm going to town. When I get back, you better have your grave dug." And then made him lay in it. We have the power to help children grow with a kind word, with a pat on the back, helping them and caring for them. We have the power to crush. I don't mean just hurt. We can crush a child. We can count at them and they think we've crushed them. "He counted at me." But we can crush them and crush what they think of themselves so easily and so quickly. The act of blessing has great power, far more than simply the power of positive thinking. In fact, one person suggests that by simply and regularly hugging them and whispering a prayer in their ear, we invite the Spirit of the living God to become a part of the parenting and maturing process. In this sense, a parent's blessing of a child acquires a certain sacramental quality. Heidi Hornick thinks that the story of Jacob's blessing of Joseph's sons is a model. In fact, in many Jewish circles, in many Jewish families, Jacob's blessing of Joseph's sons in Genesis chapter 48, verses 15 through 20, has kind of become a pattern by which very often children, especially the boy children, but children in some more, not the Orthodox, but more conservative and Reformed traditions, on the eve of the Sabbath, the evening of the Sabbath, before the Sabbath observance begins or as it's beginning, many parents will bless their children before that Sabbath service begins. In chapter 48, Joseph has brought his two sons, the two grandsons. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right, and brought them near him. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, crossed his hands over, who was the younger, and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. He blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my ancestors Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all harm, bless these boys. And in them let my name be perpetuated and the name of my ancestors Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude on the earth." When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, so he took his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's. Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father. Since this one is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations." So he blessed them both that day, saying, "By you Israel will invoke blessing, saying, God make you like Ephraim and like Manasseh." That blessing is often spoken in conservative Jewish and Reformed Jewish households as the Sabbath is beginning. especially on the sons, as the Father will give the blessing. The God before whom my ancestors Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all harm, bless these boys, and in them let my name be perpetuated, and the name of my ancestors Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude on the earth. By you Israel will invoke blessings, saying, God make you like Ephraim and like Manasseh. Blessing the children on a regular basis, a weekly basis. Blessing, not cursing. What does blessing do? What does blessing do in the mind and the heart and the life of the child? What does it say to the child if you take the time specifically to bless them? That's right. You're special. You're loved. You're someone who is worthy of life and worthy of blessing and worthy of care. A proper sense of value. You're someone that's valuable. Someone that is valuable. Interestingly enough, if you go to Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews said that this blessing is an act of faith and worship. He called Jacob's blessing an act of faith and worship. Parenting requires living today in the light of God's promised future. Unfortunately, far too many persons in the world don't see it in light of God's future. But Christian parents can set examples not only for their children, but perhaps for others around. As we seek to give blessing and not only have virtues for parenting, but also discover in parenting in such a way that we gain in virtue and we gain in blessing. Questions, just kind of to think. What are other traits or characteristics needed for positive parenting? How do we as parents and grandparents resist the temptations in our culture and of our culture? That is, materialism, consumerism, cynicism, fear, loss of hope, selfishness, and then model this resistance of culture for our children. I would suggest their share of ourselves be present with each child. Make sure that each child knows. You know, it's one thing to be present kind of in the group. There are group dynamics, and that's important to help understand we are a family. But it's also very important to take the time, to make the time, to spend individual time with each child, even if it's just a few moments, even if it's Carrie's got Avery and you pick up Addison and just a few moments with Addison alone, or Addison's in school and you're there with Avery and just a few moments to let her know that she's special. Parenting that way, being present with the child. I say that because Paige is the only one in here with young children. Encourage and guide children. Encourage children. There's so much that's discouraging out there, and their peers discourage in so many ways. I'm not going to ask for show of hands, but I'm sure that at some point in time, many of us, as we were growing up, were discouraged by the ways we were treated by others, especially if they were bigger or stronger than we were. Show more trust in God. Have more patience. Be willing to seek help and support from other people. How do we not only bless children, but help them come to know and trust in God and God's care for them? We're partners with God. It's something that we do, but it is also an action through which God is present. Something that God does, too. So parenting, I would say, once again, requires living today in the light of God's promised future. And parenting is a vocation. Parenting is a vocation. And I'm not just talking about parenting from the perspective of biologically having children. but adopting children in various ways, whether into our family or into our presence when we have opportunities to teach them and to be with them and to help them and to guide them. Bless you. Though they may not be our blood kin, it's a vocation. I look at the news, and I know some of y'all do, and I think, who in the world let these folks have children? Or who in the world put these children in this caregiver's hands? It's a calling, a vocation. All vocations require patience and work and discipline. Whether that vocation is teaching, and that takes a double dose of patience and work at best, or at least. Whether it's a vocation of being a mechanic, being a salesperson, or whatever. All callings require appropriate discipline and work. More than just a job, it's a calling. And parenting, whether biological or surrogate, parenting is a vocation that requires a longer view than just the moment and a confidence in someone greater than ourselves and something more expansive than just the moment. Parenting has to live in the moment, but it also has to have a longer view of where we're going and how important the teaching of virtue is, not only for the child, but for we who are seeking to parent, to guide. For we too are taught by God as adopted children, who is our Father, who is Mother, who is the example of love and care. And we're over by a few minutes. Go figure. Anybody have anything you'd like to add? See, it also takes a church.
I've got stuff on my mind. Probably should do another another lesson. But this whole program, I know, has been an idealistic picture.
Yeah.
You know. But I mean, when you consider the real world and how values are getting forced on people, I mean, the Bible even tells us the elect will be deceived.
Yeah.
This thing about homosexuals and same-sex marriage, you know, government is getting forced on our children. And I even read in the Baptist Courier, it's getting trying to be forced on the Boy Scouts. I mean, where does that go, you know? If we don't stand for something, we're surely going to fall for it.
Well, we will, and that is a lengthy subject for another time. However, I think, yes, this is working toward the ideal, recognizing that the ideal is difficult to ever achieve. But if we continue to work toward it, if we don't work toward it, if we're not disciplined, if we don't try and do the things we've talked about and create a different path, then not only will the ideal never be reached, it'll never even be approached. And if we don't do it, then what happens to the next generation? And if they don't do it, then what happens to the generation after that? So it is an ideal picture and an ideal hope, but it's also something that, you know, we have to try and find a way to do that within the context of the real world and make whatever changes we can that might influence what the quote unquote real world seems to be, so that someday it might become the unreal world.
The devil's working, I'm telling you. He's working. And we need to wake up.
We do a lot of things that without thinking, and that's and our children. You know, they're not just the future, the children are the present. The children are the present as well. Thanks, Wade. Anyone else? Thank you. Next week, we're going to start something a little different. You might have seen that, and a hymn title or a hymn might have come to your mind if you read the bulletin at all earlier today. But or at least down at the bottom. And folks, I'm open to suggestions for studies. But here a while back, I was actually walking along in a library. It wasn't mine. And I looked and I saw the title of a book. And of course, immediately a song started in my head. And I pulled it off a shelf and looked at the subtitle of it. And I read a little bit in it. And I thought, yeah, okay. And we can do that, especially going toward Easter. For the next few weeks, starting next week on Sunday nights, the title is Living Like Jesus. Anybody have a song tune come in your head? Yeah. And I would contend there's a difference in living for Jesus and living like Jesus. And so for the next few weeks, I want us to just take a look at how we live like Jesus in different, and it kind of dovetails with what we're doing now, but how we live like Jesus in different parts of our lives and the world now. Thank you. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.